This summer, we're in a series that we've called Good Questions. It is a series that we have been going through, and we're approaching different questions that we believe we all have at some point in our lives. Pastor Clayton approached the question, what's really important, where we dove into Mark 12, when Jesus says that we are to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. Pastor Josh approached the question, who am I? Which is a question that if you look in the world today, is one that plagues all of us, and the answers are becoming murkier, murkier, and murkier. And yes, kids, you're dismissed to your class. He spoke from Ephesians 1 and brought us to the point where we were made on purpose for a purpose. Pastor Clayton then led us through Romans 12 as he approached the question, what does love look like? And if you haven't been with us yet during this series, I would encourage you to go on our website and listen to the messages that you have missed. There's some great stuff in there. And we're going to jump into today's message, where we're going to talk about what's driving our decisions. What motives are behind our decisions? We all make decisions. I think that's one thing mainly that we have in common is that we all make decisions. Every moment, every day, until the day we leave this earth. There are decisions that we make consciously. There are decisions that we make unconsciously. An example of an every moment decision that we make unconsciously is the decision to breathe. We all make that decision. We're all making it right now. It's a decision that we don't have to think about, but it is critical nonetheless. Some of our conscious decisions that we make is simply getting out of bed in the morning, reading our Bible, eating. Not simply just eating, but what you eat, when you eat, how you eat, where you eat, why you eat. A lot of those things that we make decisions on. Think of the last big decision that you made, either personally or as a family. It could have been the purchase of a house, a career change maybe, purchasing a vehicle, maybe when to start having children, how many children, maybe a vacation that you're going to go on, an excursion that you want to be at. Maybe your biggest decision that you've had to make lately is simply what clothes to wear. And I don't say that flippantly either. Maybe you're at a place in your life where every decision that you make right now seems like the biggest decision that you've ever had to make. And simply deciding what clothes to wear seems like an insurmountable task because of what's going on in your life. For some, the biggest decision that we've had to make is getting out of bed this morning to come here. For the last few weeks, I've been dealing with some health issues, and it's not contagious, so don't worry. And last night I had another bout that I was dealing with where I wasn't sure if I was going to be here this morning because of that. Sometimes the biggest decisions of our day is simply to get up in the morning. And here's the deal. We all make decisions. Some of those decisions are good. Some of them are okay. Some of them are not so good. Some of them are terrible decisions. Some of them are the best decisions we've ever made. And with every decision made comes consequence as well, or a chain reaction of events. And it seems to happen with every decision that there's a natural chain reaction. And here's an example. An example I think we all deal with and we all go through. How many times did you hit your snooze button this morning? I have a family member who has it down to a science. She'll set her alarm so that she can hit it 6 times. Before she has to wake up. Imagine if she accidentally turned it off before the 6th time. 6 times. Or how many times will you hit your snooze button tomorrow before you have to get ready to go to work? That decision will directly reflect the pace at which you need to go tomorrow morning. Think about it. Wrinkled clothes. Spilt coffee. Speeding ticket. Then you get to work and realize your hair and or makeup isn't done and it looks like you just woke up for all of your coworkers to see. Thankfully, I live a minute away from work, so I can balance that off and rush home if I need to put a hat on. The point, every decision comes a chain reaction of events. Maybe not specifically those ones, but a chain of events nonetheless. So we need to learn to make decisions with the right motives behind them. Some of you have asked me, I've worn this shirt a couple times here. Some of you have asked me what this 4 on my shirt means. And actually, the first time I wore this shirt, and today too, I was asked if it was an announcement to our fourth child that we were expecting. Also, I got asked if it meant that I was the fourth one to pass out on our hike. I said I was pretty close to the fourth person, actually, but not quite. And I have to say, I'm not clever enough to think of those things, so no, it wasn't those. It wasn't an announcement or anything. And the shirt represents something much bigger than I am. As many of you know, I participated on a hike with one other guy from here, and it was with an organization called the Fourth Musketeer. And you'll see some pictures behind me of that trip. And this is a little blurb that explains who they are and why this decision to go on this trip is what I did. The Fourth Musketeer is a men's movement that trains men to live for their king. Jesus gave all of him to us. Together we will give our everything to him. Our service to him is our highest honor. His struggle is our struggle. His passion is our passion. His goals are our goals. Are you a Christian but missing passion? Do you read the Bible but the message remains distant? Do you go to church but following Jesus is no longer an adventure for you? Do you yearn for an adventure deep inside? Then you've come to the right place. I had heard about this organization a couple of years ago from a friend of mine and from Promise Keepers Canada. And I have to say, when I heard about what it would be, it did not instantly grip me. I mean, I'm standing at the top of a mountain in a couple of those pictures, but I kind of knew the work that would go into that, and it wasn't for me. But as I listened to my friend especially describe the journey that he went on throughout the entire process, I became intrigued. And so I invited a number of guys to go on the journey with me, and through various circumstances, one was able to come. And I'm not allowed to go into much detail, though, about what actually happened on this trip. It's because they have a secrecy thing, and they don't want you to know what I went through. But I'm going to share a story with you anyway of how my decision to go on this shaped something in me and how it pushed me to a different level from where I was. And it was on our last day of hiking, and we were making our way up the last summit. The picture with all of us there, that's the last summit that we went to. And I would say it was probably our hardest summit at that point. I was dying, I think literally, by that point. And about halfway up the mountain, I collapsed. My hips, my knees, my lungs, couldn't take it anymore. My head, because of all the pain, said I was done. I was hungry. I was tired. And I don't do things like this. If you know me, I play sports that are on level ground. There's no incline to what I do. It's level ground, and it's easy. I'm not a hiker, and this trip was extreme. They call it the Extreme Character Challenge for a reason, and the extreme was there for sure. Anyways, I laid on the side of this mountain thinking I was never going to get up. I was actually flagging somebody down, say, I quit. I'm done. I was going to throw in the towel. And just as I made that decision to myself, I looked up to the top of the mountain. And it'll be an image that is forever ingrained in me, and I believe it is a picture of what our lives need to look like as Christians. Not only as Christians, but as people. I looked up and saw my team, along with a dear friend of mine from Calgary. And we were in teams of 8 to 10 guys, so about 9 guys, scaling down the mountain. And they were walking back down the mountain towards me. My dear friend from Calgary, he said, give me your bag. I said, no, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to carry my own junk. I'm going to carry my bait, my bag. I'm going to carry the weight that I said I'd bring into this. And he said, Adam, don't be a fool. Give me your bag. So I did. And then I got up, and my team around me, I wish they would have carried me, but they didn't. They walked alongside me and encouraged me the rest of the way up the mountain. And the only reason I have that picture is because they came down. They picked me up, almost literally, and walked with me back up the mountain. And I think that's what our lives need to reflect. I'm a guy, if you know me, I like to do things on my own. I'm very confident, even if I'm not confident, in what I can do. If you look at my garage, you'll see where I started taping and where I finished taping. Because it sucked, and now it's okay. I think we're all like that. It's easier to live life to not ask for help. It's easier to live life to say, I can do this on my own. I was physically unable to get up that mountain that day, carrying all of my junk. And I say junk on purpose. Here was this picture that I saw as those guys came down the mountain and helped me back up. Because of the fall in Genesis, man has never been able to get back up the mountain to be with God. So God sent his son down the mountain to encourage us, to carry our bags, to carry our junk, so that we can climb back up alongside him. Now that is a very loose picture and translation of what happens, but it's what happens for each of us. Our decision is, do we give up the bag? Do we get up? Is our motive to get up there on our own or allow someone to help? Is our ego more important or is getting up there more important? And I'll leave that up to you. This morning we're going to jump into 1 Samuel. Well, that's a picture at the end when we got our shirts and I felt so proud. And we had a worship service as a group of men. And it was in that moment that I started hearing stories from other men that went on this trip, on this hike. Other men who struggled just as much as I did. Other men who triumphed just as much as I did. One man in particular, we were doing one of our activities, and I can't say what the activity was, but we were doing one of our activities, and he lost his wedding ring in the river. And I said, oh, you're in trouble. When you get home, you're in trouble. And as he was sharing the story, he said, I needed to lose that ring because I need to make a new covenant with my wife when I get home. The transformation that happened in some of these guys' lives was extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. So if you would ask me if I would go on this again, I'd say absolutely not, but I'll go anyway because I want to see the transformation in men. That's okay. That's enough of a commercial for that. We need to move on. So we're going to be looking at 1 Samuel 8 this morning. And let's give a bit of a picture of what is happening beforehand as we jump into Scripture together. Joshua led the Israelite people in a conquest for the Promised Land, the Lord's Land, where Israel was to enter into rest, lay under their feet, and it remained only for them to occupy it, to displace the Canaanites and to cleanse it of paganism. The time had come for Israel to be the kingdom of God in the form of an established commonwealth on earth. But in Canaan, Israel quickly forgot the acts of God that had given them birth and had established them in the land. Consequently, because of those decisions, they lost sight of their unique identity as God's people, chosen and called to be his army and the loyal citizens of his emerging kingdom. They settled down and attached themselves to Canaan's peoples together with Canaanite morals, gods, and religious beliefs and practices as readily as to Canaan's agriculture and social life. Israel was supposed to be a nation that God set apart. The Israelites were meant to be God's people, so the nation of Israel wasn't set up like a traditional nation. They had no king. Actually, they had the greatest king that you could ask for, and that was God himself. God had established himself as king over Israel. But they had no king like the other nations around them. They had people. as their head. Instead, God raised up what was called judges to act according to what God had requested. There were a number of them before our story begins. But there comes a time where what we have, and I think we've all experienced this in our lives, no matter how good of a thing we have going on, we begin to question it. We begin to question, is this actually what we need? Is this actually what we want? I think I know what's better for my life than what God knows. And that was the case for Israel. And their reasoning, they believed, was spot on. They believed that they had every reason for the choice they ultimately got. And in 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you don't have a Bible this morning, the words will be up on the screen for you. And if you don't have a Bible at all and would like one, please come see me or Pastor Clayton after the service, and we'd be happy to grab you one. Let's begin in 1 Samuel 8, verse 1. When Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as Israel's leaders. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served in Beersheba. But his sons did not follow his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accepted bribes and perverted justice. I'll stop there for a minute. From the time Israel was established, after Joshua led them in the conquest of Canaan, to now it seems as though Israel had fairly steady leadership. Of course, there were hiccups throughout and along the way. Think of the story of Samson. He was one of the judges, and if you haven't read that story, I'd encourage you to read it later today. Samuel, by all accounts, seemed like an upstanding guy, a guy that the people of Israel were okay with being their leader. But we read it here that his sons did not follow in his footsteps. It seems as though the motives behind their decisions were for selfish gain and not for the good of the nation of Israel. They seemed to be in it for the title more than the actual duty, for the stature, and not for leading possibly the greatest nation ever. So we have upstanding leadership in Samuel being followed by corrupt, selfish leadership. I don't think that's a recipe for a healthy nation. Going on to verse 4. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not follow your ways. Now appoint a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." These two verses are very key to the discussion of decisions and motives. A couple of things here. Even though Israel was set up with God as its king and Samuel as its judge, there were still a group of elders in Israel, a group of leaders among the people. And I would assume that these elders were very well respected throughout the nation. So when they came to Samuel with this, I would guess that there would be weight behind their words to him. And they got straight to the point, didn't they? "Listen, Samuel, you're old. You're about to retire. You're finished. You got nothing left to give. There's not much time left for you to lead us. And those two you appointed? Well, that was a terrible decision. Probably the worst one you made. I don't know how you raised such monsters as boys, but you did a good job. And in fact, it was such a terrible decision that we want to trumpet and have you appoint us a real king. We have a real king. No, we want a real king, Samuel. You know, like all those other nations have? Those other nations we see beside us conquering all these places? We want one of those, because the king we have isn't good enough. Part of me wonders, as a father, what Samuel's motivation was to appoint his sons. To have them set up for life, maybe. Have a good job, a good career. I don't know. Was it for the nation, or was it for them? Regardless, there was a natural chain reaction that happened. And that was that the elders forcing Samuel's hand in this request. We get a glimpse into the motivation of the elders in this statement as well, don't we? Those last words, "such as all the other nations have." We want to be like everyone else. We have the saying, "keeping up with the Joneses." Israel's elders wanted to keep up with the Joneses. Israel was different. It was meant to be different. It was meant to be set apart. And it seems like those elders and the nation of Israel didn't want that anymore. Let's continue. But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you that they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them. But warn them solemnly, and let them know what the king who will reign over them will claim as his rights." What is our first reaction when someone displeases us? When someone or a group of people tell us that what we have decided to do is wrong? I think there are two typical responses we have, and they are simply fight or flight. Either we stand our ground and fight. In this instance, I would say it would be a verbal with the potential to escalate. Or we flight, we run and hide, we avoid, and we simply sit in this pit of woe is me. When the elder said, "Give us a king to lead us," you can certainly imagine what would be going through Samuel's mind. First, you rejected my decision. I'm your leader. You rejected my decision. Second, you rejected my sons, my family, my blood. You rejected them. And third, you have rejected what God ordained for Israel in the first place. How dare you? Fight or flight. Samuel chose a different tactic. He went to his leader, his king, for guidance. "Lord, what shall I do? They have rejected me. They have rejected my sons. They have rejected you. What shall I do?" And when we go to him, like Samuel did, we hear some pretty sound advice. We hear what we need to hear. When our motivation is connection with God, then and only then do we hear words like these that we hear. "It is not you that they have rejected, Samuel. They have not rejected your kingdom, your process. They have rejected me and what I have set apart for them." And with that in mind, God tells Samuel to go hear them out. "Samuel, now that you understand that it is not you that is being rejected, now that you know that it is not you that they are throwing hatred towards, that they are denying as the proper way to go about things, hear them out now. Hear their heart, but also give them the warnings that they need to hear so that their decision can be made well." So Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys, he will take those for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in the day." Wow. It's quite a warning for the nation. And you know what their response was? We'll find out in a couple minutes. When we look over the fence, you know the saying, the grass is greener on the other side. We don't see what Samuel depicts of a king here. We see the nice pruned grass that looks perfect. But what we don't see is what happens before that, what happens underneath that. What Israel sees when they see the other nations is the paintings that hang on our walls, the paintings that hang in the big rooms of castles. They see the beauty that the nations allow them to see. When they think of a king, they see a savior for their nation. What Samuel describes to them is a thief. He describes a tyrant. He describes someone who is in it for themselves. And as we read on in Israel's history, that is exactly what they get with their first king. A thief, a tyrant, somebody who's in it for themselves. So here we go. Samuel, you know those sons that you like to spend time with, that you teach, that you raise? The king is going to take them away for his own gain. And a lot of them will probably die fighting for a cause that isn't all that important to you. And the ones who aren't good enough for that will be farmers for the king only. Those precious daughters that you have, you know, the ones that you get cattle for when they get married and land for when they get married, yeah, I'm going to take those too. They're going to be his slaves doing what he wants, serving the king only. And you see those fields of yours? Yeah, he's going to tax those. He's going to take away from you what you've worked so hard for. Oh, and he has his own farmers. But he's still going to take from you anyway. His warning is you're going to be in a world of trouble if you go down this path. If you make this decision with this motive, you're going to be in a world of trouble. And I just want to let you know that. I wonder if he said it very calmly or forcefully or I don't know. And verse 18 shakes me to the core every time that I read it. When that day comes, when you've been robbed of everything in your life, when you're taxed so you can't be taxed anymore, when your kids are dying on the field because you let them go, you will now cry out for relief from the king you have chosen. And God, the one you rejected all that time ago, will not answer you in that day. You chose something else, so God's not going to answer you when you want relief from your choice. This picture that Samuel paints for the elders is pretty grim, I would say. I don't think when they requested a king that this is what they had in mind. And it leads us to their next statement. But the people refused to listen to Samuel. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles. They're saying, no! What you just described can't be true. Those other kings look nothing like that. Those nations are happy. Those nations have everything they've ever wanted, and look at them. And look at us. We're inheriting your sons. We then get that statement once again that they said in verse 5, we want to be like all the other nations. They said it twice here. We want to be like everyone else. We don't want to be set apart anymore. We're tired of being set apart. You see what they have over there? We want it. We desire it. We need it because the other option you are giving us isn't good enough for us anymore. We want an easy life. And we believe that a king to rule over us will give us just that. The next statement I think is something that I believe plagues us so deeply. With a king to lead us and to go up before us and fight our battles. Let me sit at home on the couch with a bag of potato chips, maybe ketchup, watching a drive-in movie while you go and fight my battle for me. That's what I want. They wanted someone else to take ownership of their lives. Life would be so much easier if we could just sit here and do nothing. They didn't hear in Samuel's description that their kids would be in front of the king's chariots fighting his battle. fighting the king's battle. If we could just simply exist while someone else did the dirty work, that would be great. And here's the thing that they didn't understand. It would be the king who would sit back and have them fight his battles. To go out before him and fight, with some losing everything. The decision that they have made now has a natural chain reaction that they won't see coming. So Israel's elders have heard Samuel. And when Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. And the Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king. Give them what they want." Sometimes, as Israel is about to find out, we need to learn the hard way. Israel needs to find out that their motives behind their decisions, however well-intentioned in their minds, if not connected to God, will end in disaster. Much like Israel, we have well-intentioned motives. I'm sure those elders said, "We don't want corrupt judges leading us." Well-intentioned. Well-intentioned decisions and motives that aren't connected to God. And if you look at the course of your life, you can just see the disaster that it leaves behind. Reflect on your life a little bit, and you'll see where well-intentioned decisions, well-intentioned motives that weren't connected to God left disaster in your wake. And then if you also look back and see well-intentioned decisions and well-intentioned motives that were connected to God, you can see the victory that happened in your life in those moments and in those times. At the beginning of this morning, we talked about the various decisions that we make. Some of those big decisions, some of those small decisions, some of those seemingly what looks like small decisions actually are big decisions. Israel made a huge decision in our passage this morning. What we didn't talk about was the motivations behind the decisions we make, the motivations behind the house that we purchase. Oh, I need all this space. I need an 18,000 square foot home because 18,000 windows aren't enough for me. And, you know, we make all these decisions sometimes to be like those around us, sometimes to prove that we are worth what we say we're worth. Sometimes simply just to be better than the person next to us. What about the motivations behind a potential career change, if that's in your vision right now? I just don't like my job. I had a conversation a number of years ago with a friend of mine, a chemical engineer, bright guy, and he was wanting to go be a firefighter. He said the chemical engineering just wasn't doing it for him anymore. He wanted to help people in crisis. And we were having lunch together, and I said, "So when is it going to be time that crisis just isn't enough anymore? You're going to see people at that moment, and then they're gone." I said, "When is that not going to be enough for you?" And he said, "Well, I don't know." And so he was trying to figure out life and what life looked like and his calling in life. And I said, "We've all been given a calling in life. God gave that to us already." I said, "Wherever you are, whatever you're doing, go and make disciples, friend." I won't say his name, but friend. That is what you're to do. Whether you're a chemical engineer, whether you're a firefighter, whether you're an attendant at Tim Hortons, whether you're an attendant at a gas station, you're to go and make disciples because that's what Jesus called us to do. He had motives to go do a career change. I don't think we're terrible motives, but I think he lost sight of what our true calling is in this life. Maybe the motivations behind the partner that you marry need to be checked. I was listening to a message this week, and he was referring back to the amount of premarital counseling sessions that he does, and he was saying there have been a number of times where he meets them, they do an assessment, they talk a bit and stuff, and he looks at them and says, "You guys need to split." Their motivations for getting married might be because they think they're perfect for each other, but everyone else around them says, "No, you're really not." And the number of family members that have come to him after, and friends that have said, "We've been praying for this relationship to end. We just didn't know how to tell them. So thank you for telling them." We have certain motivations behind us that make us make the decisions that we make. And there are countless stories of heartache in this room this morning because of decisions that have been made, either by you or by somebody else close to you. And thankfully, there are also decisions or countless stories of victory in this room this morning because of those same people in your life that have made decisions. Where in your life are you experiencing heartache because of the decisions that you have made? And where in your life are you experiencing victory because of decisions you have made? We, like Israel, have to go through times of turmoil because of our decisions. And that stems from the motives behind those decisions. If we are out for selfish gain, often we lose part of ourselves. If we are out to keep like the Joneses, often we can find ourselves in tremendous debt, which then leaves a big wake behind us. If we are out to be as lazy as possible, we often won't find ourselves anywhere. But if we are out to serve others, often we will be served. If we are out to be connected to God, then we will often find Him. The nation of Israel, in my opinion, had a pretty sweet setup with God. They unfortunately got blinded by what was happening in those nations around them. They got greedy, they got lazy, they got disillusioned to reality, something that is so easily happening in our world today, so easily happening in our own lives today, where we get greedy, we get lazy, we get disillusioned to reality. Here's the reality for us this morning as we close. We, like Israel, can justify our motives and decisions to make it seem like we are in it for the right reasons. You might be in a situation right now where your motives, and you've been justifying them to make it seem like you're in it for the right reasons, to either prove it to yourself, prove it to your spouse, prove it to your kids, prove it to your family, prove it to your friends that you're in it for the right reasons. But I believe deep down in our heart and soul, we know when our motives and decisions are leading us astray. And it's in those times that we define who we are. Either we believe the truth that we were created on purpose, for a purpose, or the opposite. It's in those times that either we love God and love others, or we love ourselves. It's in those times that either we live out what love looks like from a God perspective or a cultural perspective. Our motives are never hidden by our decisions, no matter how hard we try. The motives come out one way or another. Israel wanted to be like the other nations. Their motives were seen by their decisions. They wanted what they believed would be a carefree life. They wanted someone other than themselves to fight their battles for them. So I ask you this morning, what motives are driving your decisions today? Let's pray.